You know how people say age is just a number? Well, turns out they were kind of right. Your calendar age doesn't always reflect how old your body actually is. I recently learned this when I took the True Age test from True Diagnostic. I was a little nervous to find out my real age, but get this, my biological age came back 6 years younger than my actual age. I was considering hanging my results on the fridge like we did for our kiddos when they were little. But here's the thing. It wasn't just a vanity boost. The test showed how different systems in my body are aging, like my brain, heart, immune system, and metabolism. Apparently, my brain is doing great, but my metabolic health needs a little TLC. So now I've got personalized tips, backed by science, to improve that and slow aging overall. And honestly, the test was super easy. Just a painless finger prick, pop the sample in the mail, and a couple weeks later, I had this incredibly detailed report that made me rethink how I eat, sleep, and manage stress. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com, code MINDFUL at checkout. Your future self will thank you.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
So there's a propensity to develop high intracranial pressure, and that was the first thing I released. The chronic inflammation ultimately affects the cardiovascular system. The heart rate picks up, for example, the blood vessels get damaged. And then very importantly, the inflammation blocks some neurotransmitters, and one of them affects the parasympathetic nervous system, and it's important for cognition. And that was getting blocked. So then organs would basically start to fail. Digestion started to fail. I developed rather dramatic malabsorption syndrome and ultimately malnutrition. I was even hallucinating at one point, and no one could figure it out. That's one reason why my son developed severe osteoporosis and he stopped growing. We were eating, but we weren't absorbing the nutrients.
Dr. Diana Driscoll, thank you for joining me on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you, Les, so much for the opportunity.
Diana, I got to say, you know, one of the like missions of the Mindful Movement has always been to try to inspire or to empower people to play a larger role in their sense of well-being, whatever that means for them. And a lot of that is because I felt like personally, I went through a big kind of healing journey, and I felt like for a while, the typical medical system had no answers for me. And I really relied on hearing how other people healed. And I found hope and inspiration in those stories. And honestly, I never get tired of hearing a healing story and how somebody got through something. And I think it's even more interesting when it is someone that is a doctor, that is a traditionally trained doctor that had to maybe cross over from, you know, their field and explore the unknown a little bit, the stuff that wasn't in the books when you went to med school and such.
Yeah.
I'm excited to hear a little bit more about your journey there and then see how we can maybe help some of the listeners pick up some gems that might inspire or help them with whatever they may be dealing with.
And that's why we go through these journeys, really, is to help other people ultimately. So, and I appreciate your platform to help amplify the voice. Otherwise, we can't reach that many people. So thank you for that.
Sure. My pleasure. So give us some insight. How did you are an eye doctor, correct?
Right. An optometrist by education, and never planned to get into the arena of the autonomic nervous system, the part of the nervous system you don't have to think about because it's supposed to work automatically unless it doesn't work anymore. And I got a virus when I was on a mission trip overseas, and I'm not going to blame the virus. A lot of people got the virus, but I didn't seem to recover from it. And even just weeks later, I started to develop bizarre symptoms. And I couldn't control my heart rate, blood pressure, breathing, digestion went wonky. I stood up, I'd start shaking. It felt like I was flooded with adrenaline. My resting heart rate was extraordinarily high, and something clearly had broken, and no one could figure it out. What? So that started, I had to stop practicing that day. I couldn't see my last two patients because I was shaking so bad. I just couldn't breathe. I was hunched over. It felt like my body was on fire from the inside out. How do you just explain that to a doctor? It stopped me in my tracks. So I basically became disabled and went to, 50 doctors, thinking it's not some subtle condition. You know, I cannot move past this. So I'm just not getting to the right doctor. But ultimately had a diagnosis of POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. I thought, yay, we've got answers. You know, they'll know what to do. And they had no idea. No, it was just a label that was slapped on to show that the heart rate increased when you stood up, but they had no idea what would cause it. They really didn't know how to treat it beyond just trying to slow the heart rate down. And that just didn't make any sense to me.
So POTS in itself just refers to the increase in heart rate upon standing?
That's exactly right, Les.
That's a lot of long words to say that, it seems.
The problem was the heart rate was the objective marker, which was kind of great to have something objective, but it didn't address the head-to-toe illness. I was disabled. A fast heart rate doesn't cause disability, right. So the label was misleading, and I think trying to slow the heart rate down was a mistake. Instead, the point was to look for why is the heart going so fast? And could that be contributing to the rest of the illness? And if we treat that, will that all correct itself?
It's such a fundamental question. Why is this arriving? Yeah. I feel like the biggest foundational flaw of allopathic care is they don't ask why. So it's like their questions are wrong, so their answers are never right.
That's exactly right. And I was one of those. I was stubborn. I just kept saying, but why this? Why this? Why this? And I was in clinical trials this was about 3.5 years into the illness, for about 3 years. And I thought, these are the best minds on it. They'll have some ideas. I was getting worse. My kids, meanwhile, developed POTS. And I said, throw me a bone. Give me some ideas of what you think this could be. And they said, well, we think POTS patients are perfectly normal. They're just more aware of their bodies.
That's insulting.
Thank you. I was shocked. I was speechless. And then I turned to my son who was with me, and he was also completely disabled. And I said, we're on our own. We're going to have to figure this out ourselves. So quite the challenge, but that's what it took, really, was to just bang my head against a wall trying to get help from the experts and realize I'm in the position to maybe get some answers. I'm a patient. My kids are affected. I'm highly motivated. I can experiment with my body. I have a medical background, and I won't give up. So it set me up to start to get answers. It still took 10 years.
Right. Yeah. It could be quite the roller coaster.
Yes.
I feel like that's such a cop-out from the medical side. So your kids got it too.
Yes.
Did any of that make you wonder about, there's two things that come to mind there. Like, is there a genetic component or is there an environmental component where you're in the same environment?
My husband at the time was fine. So I kind of knew the environment probably wasn't it. My son got a series of 3 viruses, and this was about 1.5 years after I got sick. So not even the same viruses, right? And all of his friends got them at school, but each one knocked him down further. And then finally he was bedridden. So
at what age?
He got sick when he was 8.
It's got to be so hard to...
Oh, God, it was horrible. Yeah, it was horrible. And nobody's helping you, right? I didn't understand why they weren't just jumping up and down. This is an emergency. My son developed severe osteoporosis. He stopped growing. He looked like he was a cancer patient. He was so thin, and he broke his arm just throwing a ball, putting on his coat. broke his arm. So he was so fragile, and I just couldn't get any help for us. It was very scary. Yeah. But when you're motivated, everything's set up perfectly. I had nothing else to do but work on this and try to get some answers. So, but yeah, it was a huge disappointment from the medical community. But I look back on that and I think, okay, they leave their office at 5 o'clock or whatever. They don't have to think about this. I thought about it 24/7, right? So my motivation to get answers was different from theirs. So yeah, it did help to be in that situation, oddly.
Gotcha. What a crazy story. It's yeah. Such a helpless sensation as a parent seeing your kid sick and just not being able to help to fix it.
Yes. So hard. And then once you have a sick child, you are a parent of every sick child. Every child you see who's not well, you know, that empathy just never stops. But James, my son, was 9 years old when he came to me and said, "Mom, you have to understand, I can't handle this even one more day." And it was like being tortured. We'd have wave of symptoms where it felt like our brains were on fire. It would take me to my knees. My heart rate would increase. I couldn't breathe. I was shaking. It'd last maybe 30 minutes or so. You felt this huge wave of anxiety, and then it would eventually pass, and you're left weak and shaky and cold. And he would go through those, and as an adult, I could barely get through them. So he just felt like he couldn't take it anymore. And we had no answers at that time. And I thought, oh, what do I do?
So that presented a lot different than the POTS.
Well, POTS is considered to be a syndrome, and you can ask any patient with POTS. Sure, their heart rate goes up when they stand. That's part of the diagnostic criteria. But the presentation is systemic.
So that's just like one symptom of really a dysregulated autonomic nervous system.
And as it turns out, the dysregulated autonomic nervous system was a secondary problem. And the primary problem was what was contributing to so many symptoms. So with my son, I just got down on his level and I looked him right in the eyes and said, "I know that you're suffering and I know this is really bad. We are going to figure this out. I am going to never give up in looking for answers to figure out what happened to us." And that gave him some peace and he was able to keep going. But I fortunately didn't know at that time it was going to take many years as those layers were released and I could figure it out. So he's fine now. My kids are fine. I'm fine.
That's great. So how old are they now? How old is
James? My son is 27. My daughter's 29. And fortunately, we've been able to move past it. And I think I am probably the most active person I know of any age. But I'm very proactive with my health now because of what I went through. And I want to approach old age with the best possibility of being healthy. So I continue to be very proactive.
Yeah, it's very common for people not to value health.
Yeah.
Not until they lose it. And then it's like, oh, this is the most important thing.
You are right.
It's the link to do everything else that your heart, mind, whatever desires.
Yeah, what was really hard for me, Les, is I took my health fairly seriously before I got sick. Nutrition was like a hobby of mine. I taught aerobics exercise classes and stuff. I was always in decent shape. And I still got sick. One of my friends said, "If Diana got sick, none of us have a chance." So that was very frustrating. The doctors would say, when I was sick, "Well, you need to eat better, exercise." It's like, already been there, you know. That wasn't the cause of why I got sick. So
what was the cause? What did you uncover? You mentioned the dysautonomia was secondary.
That's exactly right. And again, this was years in figuring it out. And I've laid out a lot of it in one of the books I have called The Driscoll Theory. But the commonality we see among POTS patients is there's some sort of chronic inflammatory process. And that chronic inflammation can be triggered by many things. Like for me, it was a virus. COVID can be a trigger. We were ready for that. Trauma, stress, injury. My daughter, we never figured out what kind of got it going. But the fallout from it is multifactorial. So there's a propensity to develop high intracranial pressure, and that was the first thing I released. The chronic inflammation ultimately affects the cardiovascular system. The heart rate picks up, for example, the blood vessels get damaged. And then very importantly, the inflammation blocks some neurotransmitters, and one of them affects the parasympathetic nervous system, and it's important for cognition. And that was getting blocked. So then organs would basically start to fail. Digestion started to fail. I developed rather dramatic malabsorption syndrome and ultimately malnutrition. I was even hallucinating at one point, and no one could figure it out. That's one reason why my son developed severe osteoporosis, and he stopped growing. We were eating, but we weren't absorbing the nutrients. So all of that was important to figure out. And in patients at POTS care, we start with the commonalities among POTS patients, like that tendency to develop high intracranial pressure.
Can you say that again? What kind of pressure?
High intracranial pressure.
How does that show it? So how does somebody know they have that?
Yeah, they don't always know it, and that's what's tricky. As doctors, and eye doctors most commonly diagnose this, but we learn in school to look for swelling of the optic nerve, and that doesn't always show up. So symptom-wise, that kind of back up a little bit, we always produce cerebrospinal fluid and we always drain it. There's a balance there. And that fluid goes around the brain, down the spinal cord. It cushions the brain, helps drain toxins, that sort of thing. But there's a balance in producing and draining it. This fluid also goes behind the eye, down the optic nerve. So as eye doctors, we know that if the pressure goes up, there's an imbalance there. Not only is there pressure on the brain, but there can be pressure on the back of the eye and the optic nerve. And we look for signs of that when we look in the eye. But in the probably 90% of the patients we see, that sign doesn't show up.
And that's just a visual thing that you see? Or is that the test they do where there's like a burst of air when you're getting your eyes?
No, that's a little bit different. That is a pressure test, but different kind of pressure, right?
Okay.
That's intraocular pressure. But this is fluid behind the eye. So oftentimes it will make the optic nerve swollen. And when eye doctors or doctors look in the eyes, you know, we can see that nerve looks kind of puffy. And that's all hands on deck looking for a cause of high pressure. But in the patients we see, that doesn't generally show up. And we can look at a brain MRI and see some clues oftentimes, but that's not a slam dunk either. So when the pressure goes up, patients can feel that pressure, but we learn in school that patients will experience headaches. That is not the number one sign we see. The number one is neck tightness, some discomfort at the base of the skull, and just horrific insomnia. So when we see that pattern, then we start digging into other symptoms that patients exhibit. And we look at the brain MRI, we look in the eyes, and then we figure it out and we treat it. There's medicine to bring that down. But again, we know that's still a secondary problem. We're still not at the root cause. You know, what kind of inflammation is driving that? And that's where we really have to play detective to figure that out.
What are the general drivers that you find in that scenario?
I've
heard a lot of people talk about going down the dysautonomia and POTS spectrum after a toxic exposure, like mold toxins in the house, things like that.
Yes, I hear that too. Probably a third of our patients say they likely experience that. But that, again, tends to be perhaps a trigger. They become very sensitive. The more inflamed a patient is, the more sensitive they get. So some things in the environment or foods or stress or light or gosh, name it, we as patients are very sensitive to them. When the inflammation is figured out, treated, the consequences of it are treated, those sensitivities go away. And they can be slapped in the face with mold or whatever, and it doesn't bother them. So again, to us, that's just another trigger. The trigger is less important than the body's abnormal response to it. And that's what we're there to figure out. COVID is causing POTS, and they say 10 to 14%, something like that.
Wow.
And again, it's not, the virus is not persistent. The virus is generally gone, but the abnormal inflammatory response in those genetically predisposed continues, and that inflammation does damage. The damage causes more inflammation, and patients get caught in this cycle, as I did. And you had mentioned, is this environmental, is it genetic? The first thing I did when we were on our own was I set up genetic disease investigators. And I thought, we've got to figure this out. There's no way I could develop this. My kids could develop this independently. My husband at the time was fine. And there's no genetic influence. So a lot of my time is spent on peeling back the genetics of it to release that to people so they know ahead of time whether or not they're set up for an abnormal inflammatory response.
So what did you find in that process? What genetics are associated with having, I guess, what, like a low threshold to the stress, like a poor stress resilience to whatever is driving the inflammatory response? Or
that's how it can present, again, because they get sensitive. I mean, I got so sensitive, I couldn't even make a phone call. I couldn't order a pizza or something. That was just too stressful. I couldn't have a normal conversation. Even a normal speaking voice was too loud for me. I had my drapes covered on the windows. I had earplugs in. Anyone who spoke to me had to whisper. I mean, that's the level of sensitivity we're seeing, right? Genetically, and I look forward to releasing this, I knew there was likely an overlap in some patients, not most patients, but this is where I started, in some patients who are hypermobile or flexible, because I was found to be hypermobile. I didn't think I was. You know, and then I tested my kids and they were too. And the doctors initially said, well, you've developed POTS because of a general development of laxity of your connective tissue and the blood vessels get more lax, the blood tends to pool and you develop POTS. I said, I know that sounds right to you, but there was nothing gradual about this. And I was triggered by a virus, and I was almost 50 years old when I got sick. And then my son was 8, and he was triggered by a virus. I said, this wasn't a gradual laxity. And then when I studied connective tissue, I recognized that the connective tissue in blood vessels is different from the connective tissue in ligaments and tendons. So unless we had something like vascular EDS, which we did not, very rare, the blood vessels shouldn't be affected. And it hit me that nobody was really thinking this through, right? But then I started to look at, and some of that's in the Driscoll Theory book, what is this overlap with connective tissue? What are the genetics of that? And again, nobody was looking into that. I just couldn't understand this. Where was the intellectual curiosity here, you know, that they were okay just throwing out this theory, and it really wasn't. And even on the surface, it couldn't be right. So it was very frustrating. But basically, what we're going to release is genetics of inflammation, that all of us are set up to be able to handle inflammation. And there's many types of inflammation. There's many pathways to controlling that. But if ours doesn't work in some part of it, and it can run away, you know, and do damage, it's not our fault. We can't get a hold of it ourselves. We need help to do that. So I think too often some doctors, not all, some doctors, when they can't get answers, they will start to blame the patient, right? And it's not their fault. They're doing the best they can in many cases. I remember one doctor saying, well, Diana, maybe you just need to meditate. And so I get it, but I was just hit with a tsunami, you know. If you can help me with the ocean that just slammed against me, I'll get my teaspoon out and help, you know, with things I can do. But something really, really bad just happened. So we never want to blame the patient. There's always a reason for illness, right?
So are you saying that it is genetics just driving all this for all these people dealing with dysautonomia?
For all of them, I don't know that I could say that for all of them. For a large majority, like.
Then how, I this this I don't understand so much because
yeah.
the genetics don't change. So like you have the same. So like if it's genetics, then how can someone improve through, let's say, dietary or nutritional supplementation or lifestyle habits? Like how would that make such a difference for so many people if it's just something that's in the code? Like how would you be able to manipulate it so much through interventional strategies?
And I will say that lifestyle changes oftentimes are not sufficient to get there, right?
By themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. If we have poor lifestyle habits, and most of us who are sick for many years, we develop them, you know, we get deconditioned, we start eating just for comfort and stuff. But I have found that changing that is not usually sufficient. There's more going on. Think of it like...
change your genes. That's what I understand. If it's
a... Yeah. But think of it like, and I can talk to patients about this, they'll relate to that. I look back on my life before I got sick and I thought, well, I was perfectly fine until I got this virus. Was I? You know, were there some clues? I was prone to anemia. And I remember thinking, why aren't my sisters prone? We eat the same foods. We get the same exercise. I was prone to constipation. Kind of the same question. I wasn't sick, right? But there were some things that were different about me. There's a characteristic of patients that tells us that they're dealing with some low-level inflammation probably most of their life. It just doesn't get to the point where they're, you know, triggered to become sick. But the inflammation causes oxidation. The oxidation causes more inflammatory problems. It damages the blood vessels, ultimately can change and damage the organs. But importantly, the brain chemistry shifts. And the brain chemistry shifts in more of a direction of anxiety-type symptoms. And it can exhibit, like anxiety less, or it can exhibit, as we see pretty much across the board, as this almost OCD, attention to detail, high achievement. We tend to be, as patients, the top 1% of everything. We like things a certain way. We expect other people to reach our high bar, you know, and it can become a negative thing. It can be too much. So if you look at a patient who's set up genetically for some chronic inflammation, they generally will display some evidence of a low level of inflammation. That's not all bad. There's some good things that come from that. But when something happens to really set it off running, like COVID, for example, that's when they actually go down. And some of those symptoms, which have, you know, society has rewarded high achievement, can become a very negative thing, and we can become crippled by it. But yeah, we don't have to change the genes. And having a genetic issue doesn't mean it's not treatable. Right. If we fall down on inflammation, it's causing these consequences, treat it. The problem is when it's not recognized and the patients get sick and no one's helping them, as we experience. But when it's recognized, a genetic problem doesn't mean untreatable. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I remember when I first went to a functional doc after being sick for a while, I was surprised. Like a couple of the first things he did was give me a test for a gene. I think it was like HLA or something
HLA-B27.
Yeah. And it was, he said it spoke to like my ability or efficiency genetically to like remove some, like, I think mycotoxins and different biotoxins. Yeah. And cross-reference that with a visual screening test to see how my eyes were like picking up contrast or something. And he was like, yeah, I think you have mold exposure. I was like, you're getting that from that information? Sure enough, checked the house, had a lot going on and had to go through, you know, a lot of work to remediate the house and such. And it was like the beginning of the healing process, essentially, like just getting, I'm reacting to stuff. But, you know, there was clearly, you know, I think any stress is going to affect that autonomic nervous system to some degree, which you could go unnoticed for a while, and it might be
And then that could affect people different ways because, you know, you're affecting maybe the way the vagus nerve is like talking to the brain and such and how your organs are working. And it could show up in, you know, a host of different problems, whether it's regulation of blood pressure or temperature or heart rate or digestion or, you know,
all of those,
or production of saliva, or like things that are supposed to be happening on the back burner that we shouldn't have to think about doing. But so, and so there was a genetic component, but it's like, yeah, still needed the trigger. Like I was fine until I wasn't.
Yeah.
And then there's interventions that I guess even though there is a genetic component, you can still treat it without having to change the genes.
Right.
It's funny. I was listening to, there's a nutritionist. He's a PhD nutrition, Chris Masterjohn, who's been providing content for probably a decade or so. And just fantastic, real like nutrition nerdy stuff. But one thing that he mentions around the genetics, around metabolism, because he makes the case that metabolism kind of governs everything because it's like the power that feeds all the other systems. But he says there's all these like rare genetic, I don't know if they're called like polymorphisms or whatever, like variants of some sort.
Yeah.
And individually, they're very rare, but there's like 1,500 of them. So when you look at a population of 350 million people or so, everybody might have like a dozen of these, even though individually they're all super rare. They might be one in 10,000 or one in 100,000. But when you have so many people and there's so many possibilities, everybody's got some.
That's right.
And that there's value in just understanding your individual map. Because if you have, you know, these set, you might do well on this kind of diet or more supportive with this B vitamin or whatever. It's an interesting idea.
Yes. And it makes us individuals. I think those little quirky polymorphisms can make us special. So
yeah, we might derive superpowers from some of those things. We don't know.
I think it's entirely possible. Again, like the changes to the brain that we see. I contacted a professor at Stanford who worked with very smart people. I said, I've got a group of people you're going to be interested in. And he said, I am interested in it. I'm just so overwhelmed with studies already. But again, those polymorphisms that can cause some things to go wonky is not all bad. And I'm hesitant to suggest we use CRISPR or whatever to make everybody's genes perfect because
right.
We lose that.
Yeah, that's terrifying. Like, who knows what the unintended consequences are going to be when
right?
That eventually happens because it will happen. You know?
Gosh.
I mean, I don't see how you can't convince 8 billion people to agree on a right. Moral technological movement or whatever, you know, more,
it's true.
You're just not going to.
It's true.
So we're going to see it unfold eventually. Might be in our lifetime, might be in our kids, but
yeah.
Can I ask you something? I was listening to you talk about the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, the vagus nerve and its role in some of this stuff that people experience. And you talked a little bit about nicotine, and I think you even used it to kind of check your math on something. Can you talk a little bit about nicotine and its role in your process? It's not a topic that we've really talked on this podcast before.
Yeah, I would love to mention that. When I was on my own trying to figure things out, I got to the point that I developed complete gastroparesis, meaning I could not have a bowel movement. And no one could help me. It had been 2 weeks. I went to multiple doctors. I was sent to a surgeon who I thought maybe he could open up this valve and allow that. But when I realized I was on my own, I thought, I was laying in bed thinking, okay, if this is a vagus nerve problem, which I was looking at the possibility that this nerve was compressed at the neck, in which case triggering the nerve wouldn't affect anything. I thought, I remembered in school that there were two parts to the vagus nerve. There's the long preganglionic part where it goes from the brain into the chest cavity and the abdomen. And then there's a gap or a synapse. And then there's a tiny postganglionic vagus nerve. And I remembered the professor at school which why I remember this is just bizarre. He said, the postganglionic vagus nerve is so small, it's almost a part of the organ itself. I thought, well, I still have the organs. So is there any way I can trigger this postganglionic vagus nerve and open up the valve and have a bowel movement?
Wait, which organ are you referring to?
The colon.
Okay.
Yes. And the vagus nerve, of course, controls every aspect of digestion, not just bowel movements. It controls the gallbladder, the pancreas, stomach acid production, and important motility. And then the motility triggers the valve between the large and small intestine to open. And mine was slammed shut.
That's the ileocecal valve?
That's right. So I suspected this was a vagus nerve problem, but I didn't know that. So when we think of trying to trigger the postganglionic vagus nerve, that you want the neurotransmitter, the chemical messenger, if you will, which is acetylcholine. That's not a drug because the body breaks it down immediately. And I thought, well, in school we learned the imitators of it, the agonists. And I thought, what is the imitator, the agonist for the vagus nerve? So, well, that's easy. It's the only nicotinic acetylcholinergic nerve in the body. It's nicotine. So I asked my husband to bring a nicotine patch home. And he was like, what are you up to? I'll tell you when you get here, you know. But I put it over the site of the ileocecal valve.
Oh, you put it right there, locally.
I did.
Oh, interesting.
Because I could kind of imagine it going through the skin. I mean, it's transdermal, right?
Yeah.
And maybe it could go all the way into the tissue, land on those receptors, trigger the valve to open, and I could have a bowel movement. Yep. It took an hour and a half. That's exactly what happened. And I used it again the next day. It worked great. 4 days. And then I was eaten up with inflammation. It looked like I had fire ants on me. I couldn't continue to use it.
From the patch, you think?
Yes.
Do you think there's... Did it feel like it was wearing off? Like, do you think you build a tolerance like a smoker?
Not yet. It was only 4 days.
Gotcha.
But that absolutely can happen. But what I did was I sent out symptom checklists to patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, POTS, and interestingly, PTSD. They develop autonomic symptoms such as gastroparesis, constipation. And I tucked in about 30 symptoms of anticholinergic syndrome, the syndrome where if we ingest a drug that breaks down acetylcholine like a poison, we get those symptoms. And indeed, the majority of patients had the majority of those symptoms. They would come and go to some degree. But because there is no blood test for this low acetylcholine, it suggested this wasn't a vagus nerve problem. This was bigger than that. This was a neurotransmitter problem. And that also is making the pupils bigger. We were getting light sensitive, dry eyes.
So acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter, but it travels up and down the vagus nerve?
It doesn't exactly travel. As soon as it's released, there's an enzyme produced to break it down so we don't get overstimulated. But it's produced in many parts of the body, including like the brain. We use it for cognition, short-term memory.
Nicotine just binds to the same receptor that it would potentiate?
Almost, yes. Nicotine will bind to the same receptor used by the vagus nerve. But it is not the same receptor in the eyes and for tear production and for cognition. So I set out to try to figure out a substance I could put together using existing chemicals. If we know the mechanism of action, could I combine them in a way that would trigger those nicotinic nerves, but it would also cross the blood-brain barrier to support cognition and wakefulness? I couldn't stay awake. And it would land on a different receptor called a muscarinic receptor. And the pupils would get smaller and we could have increased tear production. And that's how I could prove it was hitting both muscarinic and nicotinic receptors. So it was a much bigger problem than most people were presuming. It isn't a vagus nerve problem. You don't need to stimulate an autonomic nerve. It works all by itself. This was some aspects of inflammation were blocking the release of that neurotransmitter in multiple systems of the body. And that's where sitting at home with my organic chemistry knowledge that's like decades old, you know, and the knowledge I was developing of the genetics, I wanted to cover patients for any genetic problem that they might be having with the production of acetylcholine, and how could I work around those? And I put that in there too.
So can I ask something, Dania? So you're saying that, because I know people can stimulate the vagus nerve and get benefits like moving the bowels or whatever, something autonomic related, but you're saying that's not the underlying thing. It's the fact that they are having enough acetylcholine.
That's right.
And the vagus nerve can trigger the acetylcholine when you stimulate that, but that's not the underlying thing? Does acetylcholine feed the vagus nerve, or is it the other way around?
No, you're right. It feeds it in a way. Okay. The vagus nerve has multiple endings, right, throughout the body. And there's always that synapse or gap. And at that site, the nerve puts together that neurotransmitter and releases it, okay? And it jumps across that gap or synapse and lands on receptors. And then the body releases enzymes that break it down so it doesn't constantly stimulate. But what was happening, and I went through every possibility on this, Les, what was happening, certain elements of inflammation were blocking its release. So the receptors are sitting there waiting for this chemical thing.
So you're saying the inflammatory process is blocking the initial release of the acetylcholine.
That's correct.
Okay.
And when I finally came to that conclusion, I thought maybe someone has already figured that out. So I looked at existing research. Were there already discoveries that certain inflammatory chemicals blocked acetylcholine? Yes. There were. I thought, oh, well, there you go, you know. So it's a multifactorial problem, but the receptors, importantly, are still working. That's why nicotine worked. Nicotine is not a good treatment for this. That is not. One, it only works at the vagus nerve. The receptors kind of shut down. It's too much, and it's very inflammatory. But at that point, I was able to patent, you can use nicotine as a test for these receptors. And at that time, and actually still, there's millions of dollars in research into pods trying to find some autoimmune condition that is shutting down these receptors because patients present that way. But no one had ever thought to test the receptors first. Oh, that just kind of
came by just putting nicotine on it.
Yes.
So
yes,
what's...
He's an agonist.
So is there a dose where you can play with nicotine? Like, I know I've heard many people over my life talk about, like, that are smokers, like, they need that morning cigarette to go to the bathroom. So, like, that's not a coincidence. That is the nicotine binding to the receptor of acetylcholine.
That's exactly right. And you do not want to encourage anyone to get on nicotine, do you know? But it was a great diagnostic.
Well, it's a big thing now. I mean, I see...
That's a
nicotine patches used, or like pouches being really common, like companies all over the place popping up with them. There's a company, I bought some of these. I tried them a little bit. They're like toothpaste. I tried to find nicotine that had the least amount of like other stuff in it. So I found a company that makes toothpicks and they're just like dipped in like glycerin and nicotine.
I would not recommend that. You know, I have a supplement, Parasym Plus.
Does it have nicotine in it?
No.
But I want it.
I wanted a supplement blend. I didn't want to have to come up with a new drug. That's
okay.
Just take too long. But is there a way to combine current things that are available in a way that would trigger that postganglionic vagus nerve like nicotine without nicotine? And importantly, still cross the blood-brain barrier, still hit the muscarinic receptors for the eyes, and... it would also cover for all genetic issues that could be involved in acetylcholine. It took years to come up with this, but absolutely, Parasym Plus will do it. And importantly, it won't overstimulate those receptors like nicotine. You won't get hooked on it, if you will. Nicotine is very addictive for that reason, and the changes to the brain are not always good. So, yeah, Parasym Plus is what was released, and it's been 10 years now.
So what is in Parasym Plus that that does that?
Yeah, it's the combination of ingredients, and it's not like I just threw the ingredients in, right? But I wanted to make sure the levels of acetylcholine went up. So I looked at the production of acetylcholine. What does it take to put that together? And then nutrients, if we get low in some nutrients, we can't produce as much acetylcholine.
So how do we make acetylcholine? Like, what are the, I guess, building blocks, or what do we make it with?
It's very basically acetyl-CoA and a choline component.
Okay, so a choline and acetyl-CoA.
Right. But not everybody has the proper enzymes to put that together. There are genetic issues with choline. There's genetic issues with a few areas of the steps.
I've taken a bunch of choline over the years, and I'm never sure what form, like what the difference of all the different cholines are. Some of them are kind of expensive. Yeah. And like, is there a form? What form of choline do you, I assume, so you're saying you put a choline type in your Parisin Plus? What form did you use for that?
I use a form that can cross the blood-brain barrier.
Oh, okay.
And also, choline is problematic because it's so bulky.
You mean like the space it takes up? Like,
yes. Bulky. Yes. So, again, all that's included in Parisin Plus. Patients don't have to work through some recipe to try to figure out their own condition. I wanted to make sure it was easy for everyone. So, yeah, it's already out there.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. But I would really discourage nicotine. I think there's a trend for that, and that's a mistake.
Well, there is. I have seen literature, and I don't know how to interpret studies more. Like, I don't know when I look at a study if it really says what the study claims that it says. Like, it's really hard to know what's good research now or such. But I have seen research that says, that speaks to, I guess, like the neuroprotective potential of nicotine.
Well, again, it's your point of keep asking why, right? And if you ask, but why? Okay, then you understand if that nerve is not working properly, nicotine can substitute for it, but why is it not working properly? And then more importantly, is it a bigger problem than just that nerve? And how could we figure that out, right? So it's way too narrow focus when people are picking up on one thing, but it's kind of bad science because it's too narrow. It's not thinking globally enough for patients, and they miss out on...
But there's a lot of things people will do or take that's not necessarily to benefit every single part of the, like every part of every system in their body that you might just be hitting.
I have no problem with that. But if they take something that makes them worse, that's where I have problems.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you're saying nicotine can make you worse because it floods too much of the...
That's one reason. But it's also a very inflammatory chemical. That's why we're prone to say emphysema if we smoke. There's anti-collagenase, anti-elastase properties where it breaks down elastin that keeps the...
And that's not from the other stuff in the smoke or in tobacco that people... That is the nicotine itself that does it?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And collagenase, that enzyme that breaks down collagen, was really on my radar because we were seeing so many patients, it's about 40% of the patients at PotsCare, who appeared to have connective tissue problems. So that is problems with collagen. And if we ingest chemicals like that will encourage collagenase, it'll break down the collagen. That can't be good, right? So, yeah, again, we want to stay...
Is that basically what EDS is? It's like the...
In my book, there's a whole chapter on where we went wrong with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or EDS. Okay.
Save that for another podcast. That's a whole other topic.
Very basically, I think it's important to know when patients are getting slapped with that diagnosis, and this happened to me, I said, okay, what are the genes responsible? I said, oh, we don't know that. I thought, well, shouldn't we know that? How do you know it's a genetic problem with collagen or connective tissue unless we can point to a gene? I said, could it be a genetic problem of inflammation and the inflammation is weakening the connective tissue? I said, maybe. I said, okay, well, that would be a treatable aspect. Or could it be both? Could it be a gene that not only encourages inflammation that breaks down the connective tissue, but the patients already have a gene that weakens their connective tissue? That would be kind of a bad combination. And they go, yeah, maybe. It's like, why is no one trying to figure this out? So I'm hesitant to use the label Ehlers-Danlos syndrome unless we can identify the gene responsible. Because too many patients hear that and think, oh, well, then there's nothing we can do. It's genetic.
Takes your power away.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. We want to give that power back. So again, just keep asking why. When you have a diagnosis, ask more questions. That diagnosis is likely not the end.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So getting back to the thing that you made, the, I guess, supplement, Paracin Plus.
Yes.
So you say that there's, the ingredients are in there to make acetylcholine. That's the primary thing. What else is in there that allows that to happen?
To make acetylcholine, to cover for any genetic issues with acetylcholine, to maintain the acetylcholine once it's released, so it's not broken down too fast, and to cover for any nutrient deficiencies that interfere with acetylcholine. And importantly, as you talked about, not like nicotine where the receptors become kind of numb. I wanted to make sure that that didn't happen so that patients wouldn't need more and more of it, you know, as time went by. It was a long process putting all that together.
Can you speak to more of those things? Like you said, to make sure a nutrient doesn't, that you don't have a nutrient deficiency that interferes. I forget how you just said that, but
yes.
Are you saying acetylcholine can drive a nutrient deficiency and that you have to replace
that? Well, that's interesting
that?
Because it can do both, right? If you get low in nutrients and some nutrients that are necessary to make acetylcholine, then your production of acetylcholine goes down. But when acetylcholine release goes down, then the vagus nerve doesn't work as well. The gallbladder, the pancreas.
You don't get nutrients as well.
Exactly. So
what are some of those like key nutrients that you feel are like important in that?
Yeah, and they're all in Paracin Plus. Like vitamin B1 is important.
Okay, fine.
I know in my journey with illness, I developed just extreme fatigue. And the fatigue wasn't like you're just tired. I just couldn't move. And there were times it felt like my blood sugar was very low. So I got a glucometer, and when I felt like real weak and shaky, I tested my blood sugar. It wasn't low. And I thought, why am I not getting energy, you know, from food? So I thought, normally if you eat sugar, you kind of buzz.
Bring it on. I love it. I love sugar.
Well, I did my experiment. I had 13 candy bars. I just sat down and ate them all, and I felt nothing. And I went to my neurologist and I said, I'm not getting energy from sugar. You know, why is that? And he said, I don't know, but my Alzheimer's patients go through this too. I thought, oh God. And he thought I had some neurodegenerative condition, right? So as I worked through this process of figuring out why am I not getting energy from sugar, I'm getting so weak, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at the whole host of symptoms. It finally hit me that these were all symptoms of a vitamin B1 deficiency. So I took just mega doses of vitamin B1, hugely helpful. But the question of why comes up, right? So if I'm low in vitamin B1, what else am I low in? And then importantly, why am I so low? One clue I had was my gallbladder stopped working. And they wanted me to have it removed. They said the ejection fraction was next to nothing. You need to remove your gallbladder. I said, okay, talk me through this.
That seems so extreme. I hear that's so common now, taking gallbladders out.
And I read a blog from a retired surgeon, and he said, I feel sorry for these chronic fatigue people where we yank their gallbladders and nothing good happens. But the reason is, and I kind of worked through the problem, I said, is it infected like an appendix or something? You know, is it enlarged? Is it going to blow? And I said, no, it looks normal. And I said, is it filled with gallstones? No, that looks fine. I said, okay, is the opening maybe stuck where it can't eject the digestive enzymes? I said, no, that looks fine. I thought, okay, this sounds neurological to me.
Is acetylcholine what pumps that?
Well, the gallbladder is under control of the vagus nerve. My vagus nerve was not working, right? So when I was able to work through the problem, I got those organs working. And I can eat cheese every day, you know, because I still have my gallbladder. But the doctors are not there to try to figure out this intricate anatomy of the autonomic nervous system to figure out if your gallbladder is not working because of its neurological. Their job really is seen as if the gallbladder is not working and the patient is having a lot of digestive symptoms, maybe we need to take it out. But that just didn't make sense to me. Right.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I do like to pause before any major surgery and think about the science. Could something be getting missed? And I just feel very lucky that I worked through that. One reason
think the thiamine helps just because it gives you more energy, or is it related to the neurotransmitter side or the vagus nerve specifically?
Both. Yes, both.
I also have had a lot of benefits from thiamine. I find it to be a really interesting experiment playing with thiamine. We actually had a gentleman, Elliot Overton, on, who I guess speaks a lot about a book that was written back in the day, I think called Dysautonomia, and talking a lot about why society is low in general in B1 and the value it has for people. It's interesting.
Yes. And I remember when I was early in my illness attending a lecture where the doctor said, patients who are hypermobile are all low in magnesium. We did biopsies. We figured that out. So everyone should get on magnesium. And my question was, why? Why are we low in magnesium? And if we're low in magnesium, what else are we low? If we're low in B1, why? And what else are we low in? So,
well, as you get stress and more demand for energy, I would think that we deplete both those things because they're both used in, like you said, in energy production. Like I think magnesium is used for a lot of stuff. So it's like, and everybody, you know, society is stressed. We have insults coming in every direction.
You know, though, I was almost 50 when I got sick. I was highly stressed throughout my life. I had multiple businesses, 5 offices, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
I handled it just fine.
Until you didn't.
I just collapsed and I couldn't handle anything.
Well, maybe you were compensating well with your healthy lifestyle. Like you said, you've been eating well for a long time and exercising.
It was so much more than that, really. When I got triggered by that virus, that inflammation went through the roof and it was too much for my body to compensate, and a healthy lifestyle or whatever wasn't enough. I needed medication.
Right.
And the neurology was affected. The intracranial pressure was affected. My blood vessels were damaged. The heart was reacting and organs were starting to fail. I developed congestive heart failure. I had to sleep sitting up because my lungs would fill with fluid. I had chronic kidney disease. I was in stage 3 kidney failure for 3 years before we figured it out. But again, this wasn't a subtle, I could just exercise and push through this.
Right.
I was incapacitated by this. And there was a lot going on. All of it was treatable.
So do you work with people? Because you're an eye doctor. People come in and have their eyes checked.
I don't routine eye exams. All I do is POTS care now.
Oh, okay.
So we have a team.
Gotcha.
Other doctors involved also.
So you're specializing in this now.
That's all I've done for 10 years. Yes. Only POTS.
And is this in person? Do you do it like telemedicine style or?
COVID forced us to go telemedicine, which was actually a godsend because we had people travel to us from all over the world. We're still the only clinic that focuses on locating those underlying problems. So COVID allowed us to go remote, which is great. Now the laws are shifting and we need to have doctors who have multiple licenses. So that helps. But patients are usually so sick, traveling for them is extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah, yeah, I remember when I was sick, like sometimes the idea of just driving 5 minutes away felt really stressful.
Yeah, I couldn't have done it. I know, going to the doctor, there were times I was just in the back seat. I had on a neck collar. I was surrounded by pillows. I was in a robe because I couldn't get dressed, you know, try to do a seatbelt of some sort to make it to the doctor. Yeah, this was pretty brutal. So if we can help someone remotely, we're just doing the brain work. They've already seen 50 doctors,
right,
you know.
Right.
Then, yeah, that's just really helpful to do that.
So are there certain tests that you rely on that give you insight to help steer the course?
Yes, we look at everything. It really is fairly exhaustive. But I love a medical puzzle. There's always answers. And sometimes I can't get those answers until I actually speak with the patient. You can hear what they're going through. And it's like, yeah, Pott's whisper, you know, I can figure it out. But we look at all their old records. Blood work, we do some custom blood work, but everybody's different as to what we look for. We look for chronic inflammatory problems, and there's a page on the website at PottsCare on inflammatory POTS that takes people through quite a few chronic inflammatory conditions that are worth looking at. I still like the vision testing. I like to look. If I can't look directly at the eyes myself, we want photos of the back of their eyes. We want a visual fields test that tests the peripheral vision. We usually will need a brain MRI.
Well, that's a lot.
Well, when we're dealing with the propensity to develop high intracranial pressure, small vessel disease, effect on hormones if the pressure affects the pituitary, the brain
MRI. Does that really change what you would do as far as, like,
absolutely,
supporting nutrition? It does? Like, if somebody has the symptoms,
yes,
how does the test change, like, the approach? If it's like they're totally stressed, they're inflamed, they're lacking some nutrients, they're not making acetylcholine, the vagus nerve's jacked, like, isn't the goal still to just support all those things?
Yes, but that's oftentimes not enough. We're still not there yet. Some chronic inflammation can drive that imbalance of cerebrospinal fluid. And if that goes up, that puts pressure on the brain, squeezes out some of the blood flow, there's lack of oxygen. And there's some other important things that can happen, like the pituitary gland, the master hormone gland, can become affected. It actually becomes squished looking oftentimes. And that's what signals the adrenals to kick out cortisol, signals other hormone production.
What do you do in that case? What do you do if somebody's pituitary is, I don't know, shrinking, squeezed? Is that what you said?
Squeezed? Yes, yes. It's what we call a partially empty cella. A cella is like the little cup that holds the pituitary, and you can see it starts to flatten. And then it can even get to the point where it's an empty cella, where you can't even see the pituitary, right? Really? Fortunately, when you reduce that high intracranial pressure, the pituitary gland has a fighting chance to recover again. And the connection with the organs and the hormone production can normalize, as did mine and my son's. So before we do too much on hormones, what's going wrong there, we want to normalize the intracranial pressure.
So that pituitary is basically signaling to the adrenals to make hormones that are our natural endogenous, like, anti-inflammatory hormones.
You're seeing the problem, yes. Yeah.
So how do you... If that's being driven by this intracranial
pressure,
what do you do to reduce that pressure of that cerebral spinal fluid?
First thing we do is stop things that worsen it, right? And the number one, I'm horrified by this, Les. The number one thing doctors do when someone is diagnosed with POTS is put them on high levels of salt, treating it almost like it's just a mild case of dehydration. And they leave them on this high salt, and it's very damaging to the cardiovascular system, one, and it worsens intracranial pressure.
How much salt do they usually give when they do that? Do you know?
As much as the patient will tolerate. I could not believe how much salt I was put on. My son and I were taking salt capsules and did this for years.
Just like regular sodium chloride?
Exactly right. And every year I'd go back to the researcher and I'd be worse. And he said, he banged his hand on the table, just said, "I want more salt, more salt." And I said, "What is this salt doing to us? We know that it damages the vascular endothelium. That's why there's low salt options in the grocery store for patients who have cardiovascular disease. You don't want to stay on high salt." And that was the standard of care. The other thing it was doing was raising the intracranial pressure. So stop things that worsen it, and then there's medicine to bring the pressure down. Gotcha. And while someone is working through what is causing this high pressure, at least bring it down. And then
how does that medicine work? Do you know? Like, what's the mechanism there?
Yes. Acetazolamide diamox is the main medication.
Is that a diuretic or?
It's a mild diuretic, but that's not how it works. It's a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. Carbonic anhydrase is an enzyme needed to create cerebrospinal fluid. So you slow that down, our production of cerebrospinal fluid goes down, and the pressure has a fighting chance to normalize. So it's the same medication used for some forms of glaucoma, which is why most eye doctors have it in their office. It also is used to help prevent altitude sickness for a different mechanism. Yeah. It's a drug that's been out for gazillions of years. It's not new. You know,
it's
we
a weird collection of things that it could be used for. It's interesting. You mentioned salt. I find a lot of benefit from salt. And I know a lot of people do too, but I think what happens when people eat real healthy, you wind up not getting foods that have a lot of salt in it already. So like if you're not used to salting your food, but salt also can lower adrenaline. And you mentioned when you felt really bad that you felt like you were like had too much adrenaline. Like there is a anti-stress component, I guess, of salt. In that way.
Well, I think you have to know in every case what is going on with that patient.
Right.
Like in my case, salt was the worst thing possible. Interesting. Right. In other cases, that could be different. Helpful.
And it could be, how do you, like, it's probably hard to find the right dose for each individual.
For the acetazolamide?
For salt. Like, if salt could be beneficial until it's not, and then maybe it's counterproductive or make things worse, like, how do you know? That's interesting. So that's cerebral spinal fluid.
Mm-hmm.
It were, because I thought that that was kind of a contained system in a way, where it went from the brain, I think down the dura maybe, towards the tailbone, and it like cycles up and down, and it like, I guess, nourishes the spinal cord or maybe, or in the brain.
Basically in the brain.
So we're always making that and adding to that and then draining some out?
That's right. It drains through the venous system and the lymph system to some degree. So in inflammatory patients, one question I had was, are we producing too much cerebrospinal fluid? Is the inflammation triggering, you know, more production? It's possible because there is evidence of inflammatory cells in the part of the brain that produces cerebrospinal fluid. And then I thought, or is it an injury to the venous system or the lymph system where it slows down the drainage? Or is it both? Or is it neither? Could this be just a generalized brain inflammation from leaky vessels? And without doing a brain biopsy, which we're not going to do, we don't know. But what we do know is if the pressure is high, bring it down. And then patients do better. And then while you search for whatever is driving that change, we did see a ton of venous problems. We went to interventional radiologists who went into the veins and just take a look around. They were doing it with multiple sclerosis. We were really curious. And all kinds of abnormalities, abnormal fibrosis, membranes growing in there, constrictions. I had plenty. My son did, too.
Did those all go away?
No.
Okay.
What I learned from that, though, is it wasn't a one location problem, like I was looking at the neck. It was systemic. So what would cause that? If that is a chemical attack on the vasculature, okay, we can fight back chemically, right? So that gave us some answers. But some venous damage is permanent. That can you work around it? Yeah, probably. You work around it. And wonderful thing about the veins, you actually grow new ones, which is lovely. Arteries is not the case. You're given a certain number of arteries, and when those are gone. Yeah,
really?
Veins, you can work around it. Yeah, you
can. That's strange. I wonder what the rationale of the inner wisdom is around that.
That's above my pay grade.
Right, you know? Right. But, one more question about the neck. You mentioned that the symptom around neck tension, like, is there a chicken or the egg thing? Like, I look around and everybody's head's down on their phone and everybody's got jacked up neck posture. Like, could there be a postural component to messing with the drainage of that or the vagus nerves? Like, if are we just like you could pinch a garden hose and the water come out slower? Like, are we squeezing our vagus nerve where the communication is just disrupted? Or
that was my first consideration working through this, and it's one reason a lot of us wore neck collars to try to stay aligned. I did feel sicker when I looked down, but ultimately what we figured out was the reason we were so sensitive to the postural changes was that fluid accumulated, and one area it accumulated was a cistern in the back of the brain, the cerebromedullary cistern, that's right up against the brainstem. And the brainstem is your autonomic nervous system center. So any positional change would put pressure on that brainstem. I noticed, like, if I was just sitting up, I could check my heart rate and blood pressure, and then if I leaned forward, it would change.
If
I laid in bed on one side of my body, my heart rate and blood pressure did one thing, and if I turned over, it did another. And I remember thinking, the doctors are never going to believe this. What the heck? That was that subtle pressure on the brainstem. So, yes, I think a lot of us look down way too much. That wasn't the main problem, though. The main problem was the pressure, and the change in posture worsened those symptoms for that reason. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, there's so many topics to touch on that under this like field, you know, and I think there's a lot of people out there that are struggling with something that's hard to put their finger on. I mean, if somebody is dealing with this category of stuff, what would be like some early indications for that somebody might experience that they should go like inquire to someone like you or see if it fits under this category?
You know, although my work started in POTS, it didn't end in POTS. It just opened up answers about the autonomic nervous system. But POTS patients, they don't have to work at figuring out if they're sick. They just tend to go down like that. So the system, all the systems of the body are affected. The first thing we see or look for is an increased heart rate upon standing. But then I consider, what if someone who doesn't have POTS has like some sort of inflammation that affects the autonomic nervous system, and it's more subtle. And for those people, we look at tendency for fatigue, a tendency for brain fog, sluggish digestion. And I hear people say oftentimes, oh, I'm just getting old, or I'm stressed, or I need to exercise more. And my thinking is more like, okay, is that like take POTS where we're just totally disabled, and turn it way down? Is there low-level inflammation due to aging, hormones, whatever, mildly affecting that neurology, making the digestion sluggish and the brain fog more common, etc.? And could we be more proactive for those people and they could feel better? And I'd say 100% yes. So I don't think we should ever ignore the role of inflammation, for example, in aging. I don't like to hear, well, I'm old, so therefore I am going to be, you know, sluggish and mentally and physically. And so, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think in years from now, we will be much more proactive in these conditions and in aging, and we aren't going to age that way. So I'm on a mission to maintain youth, if I can, brain health, digestive health, et cetera, and keep the energy levels up. So,
well, yeah. It seems like you're doing a good job at it.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, you look very healthy, and
thank you.
Hearing where you came from, I'm sure that was, you know, it was a long road you went down, but it's, you know, I just think it's so important for people to hear those stories. So, like, no matter how bad you think you are feeling, like, there is hope. Like, humans have a miraculous ability to heal. It's like there is an inner wisdom that knows how to heal. It's doing it all the time. We just got to get out of the way, like, stop poisoning yourself or stop interfering with it and support it, whether it's emotionally, spiritually, mentally, physically, nutritionally, and let it do its thing. Yeah,
I think your message is so important that patients may not have all of their answers at this moment, but there are answers. There is always hope, and to never, never, never give up. Yeah, you never know what is right around the corner as a breakthrough for you. And there's a fair amount of research out there, so we just cannot give up. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great message. And I want to thank you for taking the time. Glad you reached out. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. If people want to learn more, Diana, and see if working with you is a good fit, where do they go?
I'm at POTSCare.com, and then the patented supplements are at VagusNerveSupport.com.
Website. You got early on that one. That's a good one. Say it again, VagusNerveSupport.com.
Yes. Again, nice. It was the patents are like started 10 years ago, before people even knew what a vagus nerve was.
Right.
So, yeah, we're a little bit ahead. But I'm in other places too, but those are probably good places to start.
Gotcha. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. Diana, thanks again for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much. I really do. Sure. I enjoyed every minute of it.
It was great to talk to you. All right. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you, Les.